Good morning. On today's programme, Brazil sets trial dates for those involved in the January riots and the closure of one of Copenhagen's top tourist attractions due to gang violence. But first, leaders of the world's richest and most powerful countries are gathering in the Indian capital, Delhi, this weekend, with global economic issues and the war in Ukraine topping the agenda. However, the substance of the meeting has been overshadowed by the question of who is and is not attending. Here's veteran Asia analyst and former CNN Asia correspondent Mike Chinoy in Taiwan.
Despite the name, this year the G20 is actually the G18. Russia's Vladimir Putin, wanted for war crimes and international pariah, is not attending. Perhaps a much greater surprise, the conspicuous absence of Chinese leader Xi Jinping. This is the first G20 summit that Xi or any other top Chinese leader has missed since the annual gatherings began in the wake of the global financial crisis of 2008. His decision not to attend, but to send his number two, underscores the profound shift that has taken place, both in China's domestic situation and in its interactions with the rest of the world. Xi's increasingly muscular diplomacy, often backed by coercive economic measures or military threats, has produced a sharp deterioration in relations with the U.S., Japan, Australia, South Korea, India, and Western Europe. This has been heightened by his support for the Russian invasion of Ukraine. At the same time, Xi has sought to promote the BRICS group, an economic bloc composed of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, as a counterweight to Western economic power. Indeed, Xi's last foreign trip in August was to attend a BRICS summit in South Africa. But spurning a G20 gathering being held in the capital of BRICS founding member India underscores the fragility of the BRICS bloc. Indeed, it highlights the fact that relations between China and India have long been tense, something that may have factored into Xi's decision to stay away. More broadly, it's a reminder of Beijing's still fraught relations with many countries in the Asia-Pacific region. This was brought home in the past few days when China published a map laying out expansive claims to chunks of territory also claimed by its neighbors. That led to sharp criticism of the Chinese position from the Philippines, Vietnam, India, and Malaysia. On top of these international tensions, at home, Xi Jinping's rule has been marked by a steady tightening of Communist Party control, crushing civil society, targeting foreign business, and scaring off some investors. A central feature of the dismantling of many of the key economic and political reforms which helped to fuel China's remarkable rise in recent decades has been Xi's move to make himself, in effect, ruler for life. But the upshot of all this emphasis on political control has been a slowing economy and a broader sense of stagnation and drift. Above all, Xi Jinping's China is turning inwards, increasingly walling itself off from the rest of the world despite the formal end of 3 years of self-imposed isolation due to COVID. Academic and other exchanges have been curbed, the number of foreign visitors is a fraction of the total before COVID, and Chinese citizens are repeatedly warned to be wary of foreigners. Indeed, for a ruler who, before COVID, seemed eager to play the role of international statesman, not only at the G20, but attending the World Economic Forum in Davos, other international gatherings, and hosting a string of global leaders, these days it seems like China's only real friends are Russia and North Korea. This is the context in which Xi's decision not to attend the G20 was taken. Decision-making in Beijing is so opaque that there's no way to know for sure what was the most important reason. Was it to avoid criticism and questions from President Biden and other leaders? Was it defensiveness over his support for Putin? A desire to undercut what the host, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, is presenting as a diplomatic triumph? To undermine the G20 and bolster China's efforts to build alternative institutions? Or, as he has become an ever more emperor-like figure, does Xi Jinping simply no longer want to attend international events where he is not the dominant personality? We simply don't know. But whatever the reason, The most immediate effect may well be to underscore Beijing's retreat from international engagement in a way that is likely to weaken rather than strengthen Xi Jinping's efforts to reshape the international order. For World Report, this is Mike Chinoy in Taipei, Taiwan.
Next, we go to Brazil, where last week the country's Supreme Court set dates for the first of three trials related to the January riots, which saw supporters of Jair Bolsonaro storm government buildings in Brazil's capital, Brasilia. The scenes in Brasilia were eerily similar to those in the US capital on January 6, 2021. And just as those events have placed former President Trump in the spotlight once again, the trials in Brazil will also put the focus back on former President Bolsonaro. From Rio de Janeiro, Sarah O'Sullivan reports.
8 months have passed since a mob of Bolsonaro supporters stormed government buildings in Brazil's capital city, Brasilia, in a failed coup attempt in January of this year. The riots took place just over a week after President Luiz Inácio da Silva, or Lula, was sworn into office. Months earlier, Lula beat Jair Bolsonaro in a runoff vote by a slim margin of less than 2%. Stoked by constant vote-rigging rhetoric by outgoing President Bolsonaro, thousands landed at government buildings on January 8th to wreak havoc, destroying everything in their wake. More than 1,300 arrests were made at the time. Multiple federal investigations were launched and a congressional hearings committee was created to discover who the rioters were and who orchestrated what are said to be the worst attacks on democracy in Brazil since the end of the military dictatorship in the 1980s. Last week, Brazil's Supreme Court set dates for the first three trials relating to the January riots. The three male defendants will face charges that include conspiracy, sedition, violent attempt to overthrow the rule of law, and damage to public property. The Supreme Court also released a book last week that documents the events on January 8th and highlights the need for an institutional response to what the Supreme Court called barbaric scenes in the capital city. Unusually, Lula's Justice Minister Flavio Dino confirmed recently that it had been impossible to retrieve all security camera footage from his ministry, which is located close to Congress and the presidential palace. He said that some footage had been deleted in the days after the riots, as is standard practice with the security company responsible for the cameras. However, he said all relevant footage had been preserved. Speaking shortly after the riots, President Lula alluded to the involvement of military police and armed forces in the events that unfolded. However, as Brazil celebrated Independence Day last Thursday, Lula avoided adding fuel to the fire. While his arch-enemy Jair Bolsonaro used September 7th as a stage for his election campaign and to spread vote-rigging rhetoric, Lula avoided making any public speeches in his ninth Independence Day as president and his first since his return to the Brazilian presidency. Former President Jair Bolsonaro is among those under investigation for his role into the riots. Although he has been demanding more headline space here recently with an ongoing saga relating to gifts that he received during his tenure as president. Last month, the federal police were given access to the former president's bank accounts and tax records as part of their investigation into the illegal sale of official gifts to the tune of around 190,000 euros. All details of the federal police investigation in Brazil are being shared with FBI colleagues in the US, which could make Mr. Bolsonaro and his aides subject to further investigation in the US, seeing as attempts were made to sell off presidential gifts in specialised stores there. Operation Luke 12-2 is the codename of the wide-reaching investigation into Mr. Bolsonaro, which includes probes into his use of the state to obtain personal advantages, attacks on the electoral process, the spread of misinformation during the COVID-19 pandemic, and the attempted coup in January. The operation codename refers to the biblical verse, quote, "For there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, neither hid that shall not be known." Brazilians are following investigations closely, and many dream of a day that Bolsonaro is behind bars. That said, Lula has not been plain sailing since he took over the presidential seat for his third time. Critics say he spends too much time trying to make it big on the world stage and that he should focus more on issues at home. Faced with minority support in Congress, Lula made his first cabinet reshuffle last week, handing over the ministries of sport and of ports and airports to members of the so-called Centrão, or Big Centre, a coalition of right-leaning parties known to trade favours for congressional support. 2 days after the long-overdue reshuffle was announced, Lula was back on the presidential plane, this time bound for the G20 meeting in India, ahead of Brazil assuming the presidency of the group later this year. For World Report, this is Sarah O'Sullivan in Rio de Janeiro.
Finally, we go to Denmark and to Copenhagen, where the government has decided to close one of its most popular tourist attractions due to gang violence. Pusher Street Market in Christiania is known for its illicit cannabis trade. It's been open since the 1970s, but the presence of organised crime groups in the area has resulted in an escalation in violence in recent times. From Copenhagen, Owen O'Sullivan reports.
If you've ever visited Copenhagen, there's a good chance you've heard of Freetown Christiania, a self-proclaimed autonomous commune in the heart of the city. With over 500,000 visitors a year, it is Denmark's fourth most popular tourist attraction. One of its main draws is seeing the open sale and use of cannabis on the infamous Pusher Street. But this symbol of Scandinavian liberalism is soon to be a thing of the past. Recent gang violence in the area, which has led to the shooting dead of a man, has prompted the government to close the iconic street once and for all. Founded by squatters in 1971 on a former military barracks, Christiania is governed internally by its residents, who vote on all decisions and have allowed the sale of hash and cannabis within its walls since its inception. Although cannabis is illegal in Denmark, the practice has reluctantly been tolerated by the Danish authorities, working under the assumption that the concentration of the cannabis trade would limit its impact on the greater population. But over the years, this uneasy understanding has been taken advantage of, eventually seeing the trade being taken over completely by criminal gangs. While these gangs have vied for control of territory over the last few decades, there has been sporadic incidences of violence and even murders, which has led to numerous police interventions and temporary closures of Pusher Street. But within weeks, the stalls and sellers would return to their usual operations. And on the 26th of August, an ongoing conflict between the Hells Angels and a local group known as Loyal to Familia saw a 30-year-old man being shot and killed, with four others also being hit. After years of uncertainty and insecurity, this incident seems to be the final straw for the peaceful community, with Christiania releasing a statement the next day saying that Pusher Street must be closed in a way so that the sales and violence do not spread to surrounding areas. And in a historic move, the community also recognised that due to the severity of the situation, it was one that they could not handle alone. Continuing, "We Christianians do not have the resources or the power to close Pusher Street ourselves and keep it closed." This open call for cooperation with the authorities was quickly picked up by Copenhagen Mayor Sophia Hestrup Andersen, who implored, quote, "not only Copenhageners, but also the hundreds of thousands of visiting tourists and the many new foreign students who have moved to Copenhagen to stay away and refrain from buying weed or other drugs from Pusher Street," end quote. This reporter can verify that so far, these words of warning, as well as a concrete barricade erected by the locals, has not been an efficient deterrent. Earlier this week, witnessing tourists and dealers still occupying the area. Stricter measures are underway though, with Minister of Justice Peter Hummelgo announcing on Wednesday the government's initial steps to close Pusher Street permanently. Police will now be empowered to designate a zone around Christiania, where the sale and possession of drugs will be subject to double the usual punishment, while second misdemeanors that currently trigger a fine will instead trigger a prison sentence. Many are concerned that these measures are too similar to previous attempts and that the centralised strategy will simply push the gang's activities to larger parts of the city. While citizens with substance abuse issues, who have over the past 50 years come to see this area as a safe haven, will be hit with these heavier punishments. The question of legalisation has also been brought up. Neighbouring Germany last month began the process of legalising cannabis, leaving people wonder why Denmark does not follow suit. The sentiments of many were reflected by Christiania's residents, who stated that as long as there is a massive illegal hash trade, there will be violence and deadly battle for the market. When asked about legalisation, Justice Minister Hummelgo was quick to deflect the question, turning it to one of a medical issue, saying it must rest on the health professional's discussion of how much damage it does to an individual. Whether this latest attempt to close Pusher Street will work remains to be seen. And if so, the long-term ramifications on the Christiania community, the tourist industry, and the security of the city as a whole are still unknown. But as Mayor Andersen says, if it had been easy to close Pusher Street permanently without moving the problem to another area in Copenhagen, it would have undoubtedly happened during the last 50 years. But there is no quick fix. But on the other hand, there is a historic agreement and willingness among all stakeholders at and around Christiania to say enough is enough. For World Report in Copenhagen, I'm Owen O'Sullivan.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, for myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.